All right, so the first time I ever took a machine learning class in undergraduate school, I was working on this recommender systems problem because I have always thought it was really cool to try to solve information overload with computers and try to help computers understand what things I'm actually interested in. So I was using this data set from a conference where they were talking about Last.fm data. And Last.fm is this social music sharing website where you can set up your music player to send what you're listening to this website, and it'll keep track of it all. And so they had a big data set about all of these people's music listening histories, and I thought it would be cool to see if I could get a computer to figure out what other music someone might be interested in based on other stuff they have. There's a weird sizzle from that. Is it okay? I don't know anything about the weird. Okay. She's gonna try to figure out the weird sizzle. Thank you for letting us know. And anyway, so was working on this recommender systems problem, and I made this model and trained it, and it said I had a 99% accuracy, and so I'm thinking, I'm amazing at this machine learning thing. This is great. And so I walked into my professor's office and said, you're not going to believe this, but like, I'm pretty amazing. Check out this 99% accuracy I have. And he said, well, actually, what's the base rate for this problem? And I'm sort of like slowly deflating as he asked this question, and I realized that what's going on is, because there are so many artists in the world and so many people in the world, the overlap between them is really small. So if somebody were to listen to 1% of all the music in the world, you would expect that you see 99% of the music they don't listen to. And so what my model had figured out was that if it just said nobody ever listened to any music ever, it would be right 99% of the time. And that's, you know, true, but completely unhelpful. And so I utterly failed at this. This is the first time I ran into this problem, and I wanted to come up with some sort of solution for this that I could sort of, ideally, if I had a time machine, I could go back and teach myself all of this stuff. And so that's what the gist of this talk is. Before I get into that, I do work for a company called Indeed. We help people get jobs. If you are interested in that, please come talk to me afterward. This is the way we're going to be talking about class imbalance today. We're going to go through these little four things. The bulk of it is going to be on the little solutions part of this. So that's agenda item number 3. But first we'll just talk about what class imbalance even is. And class imbalance occurs when you have certain values of the target variable in some sort of machine learning application that are far more common than others. As an example, here is a wine classification data set. So on the x-axis we might have something like how many tannins per whatever are here. I'm not a wine person, so I don't actually know what these things represent. But you can see that there are far more blue points than there are orange points. And this is an example of something that we would call a highly imbalanced data set, where there are only a small number of high quality wines, and there are far more low quality wines. We will be talking today about binary classification problems, although all of this stuff has application in both multi-class classification and in regression. There are a number of things that cause class imbalance. The first thing is just not having a lot of data about the minority class. So for instance, these two blue points that you see on the board here, it's difficult to know, is the true region that should be blue, is it a rectangle around these things? Is it some sort of ellipse there? Is it two different circles that just cover those two little small areas? It's difficult to know. Another thing that can be problematic is overlapping. And you'll find this talked about by Prati, Bautista, and Monard in a paper that I have linked at the end of the slides. And what they find is that sometimes class imbalance isn't an issue. If you look at the lower right-hand corner of this slide, there's a little example where you have a definite class imbalance. You have far more blue points than you have orange points, but it would be fine. You could train a linear classifier and it could figure out to draw the line right here and that would be okay. By contrast, if you look sort of in the upper left here, you'll see that that situation is a lot more difficult to figure out. So the degree of overlapping, when you combine that with the fact that there is imbalance, can be a real problem. Another thing that people talk about is noise. So if you imagine that we have these two regions on in a two-dimensional space, and we have some majority class points, or some points that are very common, and some points that are not as common, what you might find is that because there are so many more majority class points, we happen to read a lot more of those as outliers or as noisy data, and they end up being found in the region that is really part of the minority class. But because our instruments are noisy, or we have done some bad analysis, or like there's a bug in our code or something, they end up in the region of the minority class, and that can cause our algorithm to freak out and not know what to do. The last thing I want to mention as far as causes go, and this is the one that I think has the best theoretical justification, comes from a paper by Wallace, Small, Broadley, and Tricolinos. And this is an illustration that they have, which I'll walk through right now. This is a representation of a binary classification problem in one dimension. A minority class is these x's, and our majority class is these squares. What we find is that instead of thinking about this as a single distribution from which we're drawing points, what is really probably going on here is that we have two different distributions and we're drawing from them with different rates. So we're drawing from this majority class distribution much more frequently than we draw from the minority class region. And ideally, we could just put the separator between those two exactly and figure out that this is the right spot to put this. But in the presence of imbalance, what ends up happening is our separating line, or our classifier, ends up pushed toward the minority class or biased toward the minority class. And this is problematic. They talk a little bit later, not to spoil it, but they will talk about a bit of a solution that they argue for. But this is part of the reason why class imbalance is such a problem, because of the estimators ending up being biased. Sometimes you don't know if you have this problem or not. The easiest way to find out is to just check for it. Just count up how many you have in each plate in each class and see, oh, I have far fewer of one class than another. Another thing that's really important to do is just come up with some really simple baseline. So scikit-learn has this thing called dummy classifier that will just predict the most common class or predict a class at random or something. And try to use that and see what your various accuracy metrics or error metrics that you're using are between your super fancy classifier and the dummy classifier. And that can help you see if you're making a mistake that you don't realize. Last thing I want to recommend is to use better metrics. The main problem that I ran into in that example I was talking about at the very beginning with using accuracy and getting a 99% accuracy is that accuracy assumes that every error is the same cost, which is not true. If you imagine a medical case where we have some sort of medical imagery and we're trying to determine whether a tumor in somebody's brain is malignant or benign, if we make a mistake on a benign case, there is a cost there. The patient is going to worry about their health. They might cause their families to worry. It's a really stressful thing. You're going to have to bring them in to do more tests, and there's costs associated with doing those tests. But if we make a mistake and say that some malignant tumor is actually benign, and we send the patient away and they think they're all fine, it's likely that they'll die, and that's obviously horrible. So when we use accuracy, what we are essentially saying is that the death of somebody is an equivalent cost to the cost of these extra tests, which is obviously absurd. So accuracy is not a good metric to use in imbalanced situations because we often care about the minority class much more than we care about the majority class. Another great set of metrics to use that people are often familiar with are precision and recall. As an example, if we were to think about this in the medical terms that I was just saying, precision would say, for all of the tumors that I classify as being malignant, how many of them are actually malignant? And then recall would say, for all of the tumors that are actually malignant, how many am I identifying? Now, what I would have noticed if I had thought to use precision and recall when I was doing this last FM thing, I would have noticed that I had no recall. I was not able to pick out any songs that people listened to, and that is a problem. A big recommendation I would like to make is in favor of the ROC curve. Most classifiers can output some sort of probability that is between 0 and 1, and you can vary a threshold over that range and then calculate different rates, so false positive and true positive rates, and plot those on a graph to get an ROC curve. There's this paper by Sina and May, which finds that these are really good to use, particularly using the area underneath this curve, as a way of evaluating classifier performance when you're not sure what the cost of misclassifying a point is. So it can be kind of hard to figure out how much do we care about misidentifying malignant tumors versus identifying benign tumors. It's difficult to put an exact number on that. And when you're in situations like that, it can be really nice to use the area under an ROC curve because it's a good estimator for that. Okay, this is the bulk of what we will discuss today. There's a lot of things you can do to attempt to solve this problem. And the first one I want to say is to gather more data. This is kind of the like eat your vegetables of data science, where we all recognize that it's a good thing and we all recognize that we should do this, but none of us want to. So I want to just make a big note that if you can gather more data, it makes all of these problems a lot more easy to deal with. Beyond that, There's a really good survey paper by Branco, Torgo, and Ribeiro that I have linked at the end of these slides, which, by the way, I will tweet out in a second, and they're also there's a link to them at the end of the talk. They talk about solutions in terms of pre-processing, special purpose learners, and prediction post-processing. So that's the way that we're going to go through the solutions today. The first we will talk about is pre-processing. And when people talk about pre-processing, what they generally mean is changing the amount of data that you have in each class. So if we had this example data set on the left, we could either oversample it or undersample it, and we'll talk about oversampling first. In oversampling, we are trying to make more examples of the minority class. So in the case of random oversampling, we just duplicate points in the minority class and we feed those into our model. There's other algorithms like SMOTE and Adison that try to do something a little bit more clever. SMOTE stands for Synthetic Minority Oversampling Technique, and it is originally from a Chawla paper that is, again, linked. And it sort of takes these steps. The first thing you do is you select some point that's in the minority class, and then you find some points that are nearby, and then you pick a point that is some percentage of the way between them, and sort of interpolate a point between the minority class points. And then you keep doing that until you reach some desired level of balance. By doing this, we end up getting sort of this kind of behavior where you see with random, we just have the same points duplicated over and over again, whereas with SMOTE, we kind of define the region a little bit more and carve out this space as being the minority area. But we could also go the other way. We don't have to oversample, we can also undersample. We talked about noise being a problem earlier, so I want to zoom in on this little part of our graph here to explain what I mean. There's a concept called Tomek links. Tomek links happen when you have two points that are each other's nearest neighbor. So they are the point, there's no other point that is closer to either of them than each other, and they're of different classes. The intuition or the argument goes that one of these points is wrong. We probably measured one of these points noisily, and it is not truly the majority class. It should really be a member of the minority class, or it's just noise and we throw it away. And when we're using Tomek links as an undersampling technique, what we do is we just throw away the majority class point and we figure we have a lot of points in that class, it will not affect us too bad. But there are other simpler techniques as well, like undersampling, random undersampling, where you just randomly throw away some of the majority class points. And that's actually what the Wallace paper argues for. So what they find is that by throwing away some points out of the majority class, we end up getting these separators in this green area that I've highlighted here. And in the green area, you'll see that all of these separators are better than the biased purple estimator that we would get if we did not do undersampling. So that's great. We're decreasing the amount of bias that we have. However, you may notice these points or these different separating lines are going to have different performance levels. And that can be problematic. And what ends up happening is we have a high variance situation. So in the face of high variance, these authors recommend that you bag together classifiers. So take and come up with 11 different random undersamplings of the data and train a model in each of those and then bag them together to form your end classifier. For all of these techniques, if you're using Python, you should use this library called the Imbalanced Learn, so that way you don't have to re-implement stuff yourself. Okay, pros and cons of pre-processing. Great thing, libraries exist, which is awesome. The fact is that it gets us closer to what we actually want to have happen. We want a less biased estimator. Keep in mind, though, that when you are changing the amount of data that you have, that will change the cost of training your model. So if you are oversampling, then you will end up having a lot more. You'll end up having a lot more data, and it might be very difficult for you to. Have the compute available to calculate this classifier if you have a lot more data. By contrast, if you're undersampling, you won't need to spend as much time on compute because there's not as much data. So that's not necessarily a good or a bad thing, but just something to keep in mind. The last thing I want to note is that it can be difficult to apply different sampling techniques because, for instance, SMOTE is not super well defined for categorical data. There are extensions for it, but I find them to be somewhat not intuitive. Another thing that can be difficult about this is that it's difficult to know exactly what level of oversampling or undersampling you want to do. The next thing that we will talk about are special purpose learners, and you may have already seen some of this. These are just API documentation that I have pulled from various libraries that I like and highlighted the fact that a lot of them have a way to specify some sort of weighting on the classes. And what this does is different depending on what the model you're using is. So on a tree model, like a decision tree, or if you're using XGBoost or LightGBM, it's going to affect the impurity calculations that it does as it's trying to figure out the Gini index or the entropy or whatever as it tries to determine a split. Instead of just assuming that we have equal costs there, it will weight those costs and make those splits more effectively. It will also affect the voting that happens at prediction time. So if we end up with a situation where we have 99 majority class points in a leaf and one minority class point in that leaf, but we've upweighted the minority class, it will get extra voting power when it's making that prediction. One thing that's really cool is that when you're using like an SVM and do weighting, it will actually push the hyperplane away from the minority class and thereby try to sort of counteract what Wallace was talking about in that paper by moving that hyperplane away from those points. When you do this for k-nearest neighbors, it changes the distance metric. And when you do this for other models, it changes other things. The tricky thing about these methods are that they are very algorithm dependent. And depending on the algorithm you're using, they might not have class weight already implemented, and you might have to implement that yourself, which would not necessarily be the most fun thing in the world. But yeah, we might wonder to ourselves, is this a good option? Like, should I actually use this? And the best way to know that is to know when it actually works. When you have extremely high levels of imbalance, so 0.0001% of your points are in the minority class, you will find that this is a less effective technique. The Wallace paper finds that as you get more imbalance, that this technique of using weighted empirical cost minimization is going to be less effective. They also find that when you have more data, this technique is more effective. So this is another argument for eating your vegetables. Make sure you gather more data because it is often useful to have more data and it often solves problems. So some good things. This does directly address the issue. A bad thing, again, it still requires you to know the cost trade-off structure that you have. And it can be effective when you have a lot of data and your data is more close to balance, but it can be difficult to do this if it's not already implemented in whatever algorithm you're using. Finally, let's talk about prediction post-processing. So here I want to talk about threshold selection and cost-based classification. We'll talk about threshold selection first. The main thing I want to emphasize here is that if you need to make a hard cutoff of do we call this patient back or not, you should choose that threshold based on optimizing the metrics that you care about. Because I mentioned precision and recall earlier, I'll use those as examples. But again, here what we would do is take the probability output by our classifier, vary it from 0 to 1, and then calculate precision and recall at each of those points and determine what we wanted to have happen. If we were in this medical example, we would probably want something that had high recall and we're willing to sacrifice precision because we want to make sure that anyone who is sick, we call back, and we're willing to accidentally screen some people who aren't truly sick to have that benefit. Quick note, don't use your test set to do this. I did this on accident once, and it is an easy way to overfit your data, and that will trick yourself into thinking you're doing better than you actually are. The last method I want to talk about is cost-based classification, and this comes from that Cena and May paper I quoted earlier. The gist is that at each point on an ROC curve, we can calculate some cost, and they propose this formula for doing so. So this ends up being basically how much of your class is the minority class times the cost of a false positive times this number we can read off of the ROC curve, and then you add the cost for the positive side of things. So we can plug in our numbers from our ROC curve, and then the blue numbers are the way that we say here is how much I care about each individual case, and orange numbers are just a way of us telling it here are the relative percentages of each of these classes. And then we can calculate the cost. So here we can see that the various thresholds have various different costs. And the lowest one, which doesn't look like the slides worked super amazingly, but you can see that the lowest one would be this 0.64 number has lowest cost, and we would use that as our threshold. I want to make a quick note that this is different from the idea of a special purpose learner, because it isn't modifying the learning algorithm at all. So we don't actually weight them while it's learning at all. And as such, you can use it with almost any model and you don't need to adjust the algorithm in any way. So there are good things and bad things about this. The good thing is it's really straightforward to just choose your threshold more wisely. The default that you're getting is often not the right answer. And this is able to be used with most models. Furthermore, there is a problem though. This technique hasn't really been studied a whole lot in imbalanced domains, so it might not be the best approach, although it is an interesting one to try out, for sure. That is a lot of things. So let's just summarize real quick. But these are some recommendations that I have based off of the reading that I've done and the experience that I've had in my own work. The first thing I would recommend doing if you're dealing with an imbalance problem is to establish some baseline. So have a really simple dummy model that will just predict the most common class and compare that to your actually smart model. And that way you can avoid tricking yourself into thinking you're doing really well when you actually aren't and embarrassing yourself in front of your coworkers. I would also recommend using AUC unless you have some other metric that you think is really good for this situation that you particularly have, as it is unbiased in these situations. Then after that, if you do have class weights for this algorithm, just try it, because it can often be a nice way to put your thumb on the scale in favor of the minority class. If that doesn't work, we can sort of step up further on this Maslow's hierarchy of needs and choose a threshold more wisely. By default, scikit-learn will often just give you a threshold of 0.5, and that's not always what you want. After that, if you want to try some pre-processing techniques, I would highly recommend using random techniques. The reason I would argue for that is because Wallace finds that in almost all imbalance scenarios, practitioners should bag classifiers that were induced over balanced bootstrap samples. There was another study that they actually found by comparing random oversampling and SMOT and some of these other more complicated oversampling techniques, that random oversampling was extremely competitive with these more complex methods. I will note that while it seems kind of contradictory, one of them is telling you always undersample and one of them is telling you, you know, oversample. Part of the reason for that is the Batista paper doesn't look at this bagging method, and so they may be seeing some of that variance in their error calculations. The last thing I would say after you have explored these other techniques is you can look into more expensive stuff at that point, but you're kind of going to be eking out incremental gains, which may be valuable in certain situations, but may not be, depending on what you're after. So that would be the last thing to try, is trying out SMOT or some other techniques like that. Want to give another last shout out to my employer, which is Indeed, for supporting me to do this stuff. My slides are available at this link, which is go.indeed.com/devweek19. I'll be hanging around here afterward if you have questions. I would love to talk with you, even if it's not about class imbalance. If it's just about data stuff, that is always interesting to me, and I would love to chat with you. So that would be great. If you have somewhere to run to, feel free to email me. My email is up here, or you can tweet at me. Either one, I'd love to talk to you about. And with that, I will be hanging out and talking to you with questions if you have any. Thank you.